This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, it's a double issue of the magazine.
Well, last week, we brought you the cover story featuring The Gospel According to Kathy Wood. The issue is still on newsstands and available online at Bloomberg.com and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
So this week, Tim, we're going to take everyone inside Apple's battle. Well, kind of against everything.
Plus, we speak with Anthony Noto, the CEO of SoFi. They just went public this week with the help of a blank check company, better known as a SPAC.
I've heard of them.
They're back.
They are. Not a new idea, but nonetheless, there is quite a mania when it comes to those blank check companies. Also, we're going to hear from the beer and wine industry about how a pandemic has changed the way Americans consume alcohol.
All of that to come. We begin, though, with a reminder that this week marked the 100th anniversary of the race massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the community known as Black Wall Street. Today, dozens of attorneys and activists are involved in a lawsuit against the city of Tulsa. Attorneys representing survivors and their descendants are calling for, in part, reparations. They also want justice and more accountability from government officials.
Well, Tim, back in April, the U.S. House of Representatives agreed to discuss the possibility of establishing a commission to study reparations more than 30 years after the proposal was first introduced. President Biden called the plan a good idea. As for full reparations from the federal government, it probably won't come anytime soon.
That said, the city of Evanston, Illinois is already getting started. Joining us with an article in, it's a feature in, the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, available on news stands and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg News, and Susan Burfield, projects and investigations reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. They join us from Brooklyn. Joel, I'm wondering about this because reparations, or at least how Evanston is defining reparations, are a lot more complicated than just giving people money.
That's right. And I just thought this story that Susan and her colleague Jordan Holman worked on for the magazine was amazing and perfectly timed. And I think the reparation story is one that has been, you know, one of the most interesting to watch. Evanston, Illinois, is particularly interesting because this is the first U.S. city to really promise that they would take this stuff on. And boy, that's not easy. It turns out even the word reparations can be controversial. So Susan, can you help us understand what Evanston is going through and where it might go from here?
So, you know, as you said, there's kind of two efforts underway throughout the country. There's an effort at the national level, at least to begin talking about a federal reparations program that would probably come to trillions of dollars. For every eligible African American. And then there are cities like Evanston that are looking at what the local cases for reparations, for, you know, injustice, discrimination against Black residents that the cities themselves are responsible for and that they can pay within their budget. So that's usually programs of millions of dollars. In the case of Evanston, $10 million.
And Susan, they're doing this through the lens of real estate. Explain why that is.
You know, for a city like Evanston, it's not going to attempt to make restitution for something as huge as the years of slavery. But what the city wants to take responsibility for and is holding itself accountable for is for housing discrimination that Black residents faced in Evanston for several decades. That contributes, as we know, everywhere to a racial income gap of almost 7 times between Black and white families. And, you know, in Evanston, it's pretty well documented the ways in which Black residents at one point lived all over the city, and then over the course of about 2 decades, were all steered toward one neighborhood in Evanston, now known as the Fifth Ward.
And Susan, can you, you know, rewind the clock, because this goes back actually decades in Evanston? What happened?
Yeah, so, you know, Evanston can document kind of the first arrival of Black residents to the late 1850s and 60s. And over the years, you know, there were increase number of Black residents, especially the Great Migration of the 1920s. And as more Black residents settled in Evanston, there began kind of official and unofficial codes and restrictions on where they could live. And then there came redlining, which was a national policy, but also took place in Evanston, that further made it difficult for Black residents who now were all living in this one fairly concentrated area to get a fair mortgage. And that policy, you know, plus underinvestment by the city, you know, results in a neighborhood where the property values are lower than elsewhere in Evanston. The homes are worth less, and families were lost wealth. In one of the stories that we highlight of Carlos Sutton, his home, his grandfather's home, was actually moved from one part of Evanston to the Fifth Ward, and the home, had it been remained where it was, I'm sorry, would today be worth maybe $500,000. Where it is now, it's worth about $150,000.
That was Business Week Projects and Investigations reporter Susan Burfield and Business Week editor Joel Weber. The Evanston story is one we'll be keeping an eye on for months and years to come.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's been thought about for years already, but let's see if it actually moves forward. Coming up, one of our biggest interviews of the week. We're talking about SoFi CEO Anthony Noto. He joined us to talk about his company's first day of trading on the NASDAQ and why a blank check company was its best option for going public.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
It went public via a SPAC this week, and it was a SPAC backed by venture capital investor and what many have called the Pied Piper of the blank check world. We're talking about Chamath Palihapitiya.
We're talking about the fintech firm Social Finance, better known to many people as SoFi. The company raised almost $2.5 billion to fuel growth. To find out more, SoFi CEO Anthony Noto joined us.
And his name is probably pretty familiar because he, of course, was the former COO and CFO over at Twitter, former Goldman Sachs partner, and now his current company among the latest to capitalize on this popular investment vehicle.
I think each company has to evaluate the different ways to go public based on their facts and circumstances. And for us, this was a great option. We had a few things to consider. First, we wanted to convert our capital structure that was largely preferred shares to common shares. That was a necessity for two reasons. One, in order to file with the Federal Reserve for a bank charter, we needed to have common equity. Second, to become a public company, we also needed to make that conversion. We also had two capital needs. First, we had bought Galileo in March of 2020. And with that came a seller note, and that note was going to be due in March of 2021. So that was one capital need. A second capital need was to finance the bank if and when we were able to achieve a charter. And so we were raising private money at the time, and we got approached by a number of investors that wanted to put even more capital into the company and also considered supporting us in going public. And so what we ended up doing was choosing a private round with T. Rowe Price, who invested $375 million, and we closed that on or about December 27th. We launched the PIPE, confidential PIPE process on the 28th, and we were able to complete that by the 31st, and then announced the combination of those two and the third leg of the stool, which was a SPAC merger with Social Capital head of Sophia 5 on January 4th. And the combination of those three pieces made it a unique approach for us to raise capital and go public at the same time. And it was the right outcome for us versus a regular way IPO or a direct listing.
Well, no shortage of SPACs out there. So why Social Capital, head of Sophia, founded by Chamath Palihapitiya?
We were approached by a number of different SPACs, and we were confident that we were ready to become a public company. We knew we would have to go through a pretty detailed, more detailed process from a diligence standpoint than going public because it's a merger. And we thought that Chamath's team brought one, first and foremost, a strategic perspective to the table for us, and that we could partner on different strategic opportunities over time. Number two, they had great experience in conducting the type of diligence of a company like us, as they've done with other companies. to make sure they brought the credibility to the PIPE investors when they made the announcement and brought us to PIPE investors. Three, they had great experience in executing SPACs. And so the combination of strategic value, the diligence process that we knew would bring incremental credibility to the PIPE investors, and then three, expertise in having done this before were the three factors and why we chose Social Cloud. It was a tough decision. We brought three options to the board. It came down to the wire, and the board chose Social Capital.
So you guys are all in. There's student loans, there's personal loans, there's home loans, there's insurance, small biz financing, investing. There's a lot on your platform. Will crypto be part of it at some point?
We do offer within Invest the ability to buy single stocks without commissions, fractional shares, which we pioneered, robo-advisory accounts, which we've created ourselves. We also have five SoFi ETFs. And we do offer cryptocurrency. We offer 18 different coins. We do it in a very appropriate way in that we disclose to you the volatility of that asset class and the risk that you could lose all of your money every time you put in a buy order that is disclosed before you hit the buy button. It is an asset class that our members want, and right. We want to provide diversified selection for them.
Because you have an array of services that you can offer folks on the platform, what do you think is going to be the best growth opportunity, provide the best margins for you? Where's going to be the big business in your view?
You know, we design each one of the businesses to be best in class from a consumer value proposition, but also best in class unit economics. And so we design them all to be attractive on their own. We do get incremental benefits when people take the second, third, or fourth product with us, but they have to stand on their own, both from a value proposition to the consumer and a unit economic standpoint for us financially. And the reason why we do that is we want to meet the member where they are with mm-hmm. what they want as what we make money on.
So you're saying all of it's going to be lucrative. There isn't one of the things that you said, okay, this is going to be our bread and butter.
Yeah, they're all architected over the long term to be standalone, viable, attractive businesses by themselves. And many companies are in just one of the product categories. Many are just in mortgage, just in student loans, or just in brokerage, or just in checking or savings.
I want to talk a little bit about profitability and SoFi's path to profitability. You currently lose money, more than $200 million in 2018, 2019, and 2020 each year. What is the path to profitability, and when do you get there?
Well, we achieved positive EBITDA in the fourth quarter of 2020. It was our first quarter of positive EBITDA since we embarked on such an ambitious strategy to become a one-stop shop and comprehensive suite of financial services products all on one app. So we made a significant amount of investment in 2018 and 19 and started to bear fruit of that investment in 2020, hitting positive EBITDA in the fourth quarter of 20. And again in the first quarter of 2021. And on a trailing 12-month basis, as you'll see in our financial disclosures, we've also achieved positive EBITDA. So from a profitability standpoint, as it relates to non-GAAP metric of EBITDA, which we think is the best measure for cash flow, we've gotten to that point. Now, each one of our businesses is not profitable. Our lending business is very profitable. It's a very, very well-growing business. You can see the growth rates for the business in our filings, but it's a high grower, but also very profitable. Our technology platform is a even higher grower business with great profitability as well, with about 30% margins. And then our financial services business, which consists of SoFi Invest, SoFi Money, and SoFi Credit Card, that's an acquisition business where we recoup the customer acquisition costs we make in year one over the year and a half to 2 years after we acquire them. So on a per account basis, we may be hitting profitability, but because we're acquiring more customers than we currently have that are profitable, it shows a loss in that business, which is also seen in our financials. But we focus on unit economics for each one of our business and per loan economics to make sure that overall these businesses can be great unit economic businesses individually and in total. And so we're balancing both growth at a high rate with profitability in the overall mix.
That's SoFi CEO and former COO and CFO at Twitter, Anthony Noto. Noto explained to us why the company chose to go the SPAC route versus a traditional IPO, though I think it is part of a broader conversation, Carol, about why some companies choose to forgo the traditional IPO process, the roadshow, what's referred to as that S-1 filing,
right,
and do a SPAC instead.
All right, still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, finding that work-life balance in the wake of Zoom meetings and online learning. I don't know about you, Tim, but I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think we all are. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Having it all, doing it all well, not easy being a working parent. We know that, especially hard during the pandemic, when so many were working or worried about keeping their jobs while at the same time taking care of and often schooling their kids at home because of the pandemic, or even taking care of elderly family members.
Yeah, someone who knows a lot about that is Daisy Dowling, founder and CEO of WorkParent. It's an executive coaching and training firm. She's out with a new book. It's called WorkParent, The Complete Guide to Succeeding on the Job, Staying True to Yourself, and Raising Happy Kids.
And Tim, we started by asking about how and why she created this resource for working mothers and fathers.
So when I started writing this book, I wanted it to be the book that I myself needed to read, both as an executive coach and as a mom. So for years, I worked with hardworking men and women who were trying to get ahead on the job and fulfill their ambitions and earn a living, build their careers, all while at the same time being the present, loving parents they wanted to be. And I could advise them professionally, but I didn't have such great advice or tips or a single resource I could point them to that would help them do both of those things at the same time. And then when I became a mom 9 years ago, I got, you know, the problem came home with me and I saw it for, you know, firsthand myself. I couldn't figure out how to find care, how to talk to my boss's boss about still wanting to get that promotion, even after I had just had a baby, and every, you know, practical and ambition-related question in between. And because I couldn't find that single source resource, that one complete cookbook, I decided to write it.
Well, I got to say, it reminds me of when I was pregnant and what to expect when you're expecting, because I just felt like it kind of takes you through different parts of that book, your pregnancy, but this takes you part, you know, through different points of being a working parent. You know, there's one thing that jumped out at me about communication, and I like this, communicating with the village. We do talk about it takes a village, you know, to raise kids, to kind of do anything in this society. But how you communicate with that village is a really important thing.
It is. And listen, throughout the course of the pandemic, working parents have been so stretched and pressured that we're not doing a lot of communication when we don't need to, right? Our boss calls, we answer. Our kid needs, help getting into distance learning, we're on it. But in terms of that kind of back and forth, the proactive communication with your child's caregivers, with maybe relatives, with extended members of your community, with all the people you're looking to and want to look to now in the new normal to help you not just raise your child, but build your career, you really want to think about how much you're in front of those people, what kind of connections and touch points you're having with them, and have them not be on a need to or must basis, but really be ones where you're building that relationship and making sure that village is a strong one.
So what's different about, I'm one of seven kids. My mom was a stay-at-home mom until we got a little bit older. And we were all, or some of my older siblings were heading off to college. Is it tougher being a working parent today than it was a few years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago? And I'm trying to think, 20 years ago isn't so long ago. It's, the year 2000.
Yeah. It's such a great question. And so many of my coaching clients grapple with this. You know, I saw my parents do it. I see, you know, some of the very senior people at work, you know, they've done this. Why is it so hard for me? And we beat ourselves up about that. But here's the thing. Working parent doesn't just feel harder or seem harder. It actually is harder for a couple of different reasons. First of all, the way you're a working parent now, whether you're part of a dual career couple or if you're a single or solo parent, you are operating in a frame that your parents maybe didn't have to, and your grandparents almost certainly didn't have to. There was much more likely that one partner, one person at home, was going to be more available to look after the great big task of raising the family. And then think about it from a technology perspective. So even if you were a working parent back in 05, 06, that's not really that long ago, right. But you weren't doing it with that kind of 24/7 pressure and constant communication and that feeling of always being on that we now have because of the smartphone. Now, don't get me wrong. I love my iPhone as much as the next person, and it's a great tool. It allows for a lot of flexibility.
Do you really?
I do.
I'm kidding a little bit, but I'm also, it's something that really kind of keeps us going 24/7.
It does. It does. And that's not something that, you know, 20 years ago that your mom or that your mentors had to do. So there's a constant pressure. I keep telling people we're in a new game here and we've got to get a whole new set of tools and ways of thinking about working parenthood that will keep us on our front foot.
That's Daisy Dowling, founder and CEO of WorkParent, an executive coaching and training firm.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, it's the CEO of Land's End on his company's growth and the possibility of becoming a meme stock.
I got to say, it was a fun conversation. I really enjoyed it. I really also found it interesting kind of how they're evolving the company. It's a brand that's been around for a long time, but they're figuring out how to kind of keep it going.
Yeah, who didn't have one of those backpacks with their initials on it when they were a kid, right?
Exactly. I bought a few uniforms from the company. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Not sure if you've noticed, probably should, shares of Land's End, they're on a tear up kind of around 40% this year.
The retailer also raising its full-year guidance for sales and earnings after it posted first-quarter results that exceeded an earlier company forecast. One big reason why? E-commerce sales that have brought in a lot of new customers.
Land's End CEO Jerome Griffith joined us with a look back, a look forward, and about the possibility of being a meme stock.
The conversation started with a look back at those fraught early days of the pandemic just about 14 months ago.
Well, obviously, about a year ago when we went into lockdown, it was a real shock for everyone. And, you know, we shut doors and furloughed folks and took salary reductions very quickly and were able to try and adapt to whatever the new normal was going to be. Our demand went down in March last year, but very quickly rebounded in April and then went on a tear for the rest of the year. You've seen a lot more consumers shopping online, and most of those consumers have been coming from Gen Xers and baby boomers who have not been comfortable shopping online before. And since our business is an e-commerce business, we've been the recipients of a big increase in demand and a big increase in new customers. We just this past quarter reported 71% increase in new customer acquisition and retaining them over 55% into active.
Wow.
So we've been seeing some really good numbers. And I've got to say, our troops have been extremely resilient. Mm. The folks that work in our facilities in Wisconsin have been just great to work with, and we've seen some really great performance there. Everybody's been working from home. We've been designing lines from home. We've been using 3D design. We've been using architectural boards so our designers can share ideas back and forth while working remotely. And what we've actually found is we've done a really good job. We've been extremely efficient. Our folks are very happy working remotely. And as we get ready to return to the office in September, we're going to see a pretty liberal hybrid work environment where people are being just as creative, if not more creative, and coming up with great new ideas for us to continue to move the business forward.
That is really fascinating because it's in contrast to really what we're seeing in the financial community where there is it feels like a real big push to get everybody back to the office. Does it mean, though, Jerome, that you guys might give up some real estate space because you just won't need it?
No, we own all of our real estate in Wisconsin, so there's no sense to give anything up. What we might do is repurpose some of it, and we're thinking about that. But no, generally, we'll have people coming back into the office on a hybrid schedule, and we may move people from one building to another to make it more efficient, but that would be about it.
So when you talk about repurpose, does that mean you might rent it out to other folks?
We could. We haven't made it that far yet. We're still in the thinking stages right now.
All right. So talk to me about retail trends. You said that you guys had a lot of new customers actually come on. What were people buying during the pandemic? And what about those trends, if they were different from pre-pandemic levels, do you think stays with us?
Going into the pandemic, we had already had a tagline for marketing purposes that said, "Let's get comfy." The most important thing to our consumer is comfort and fit and fabric. And while that was performing extremely well going into the pandemic, as we went through the pandemic, the requests for knitwear, loungewear, sleepwear, home, bedding, bath towels really went through the roof. I would say the only thing that was more of an anomaly for us was the quick increase in home. But generally, people come to us for comfortable clothing. We are known as a very casual brand, and we've seen the demand not only continue to increase through the pandemic, but as we're coming out of it, it continues to stay very strong. We think that as people return to the office, you know, the newfound comfort world, they're not going to want to give it up. We found that our employees don't want to give up the freedom that they have, and they don't want to give up the comfort. And this is what we're hearing from our customers as well.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. But I agree. I see it even in colleagues who come back. I mean, I walk in a pair of jeans. I don't know that I used to do that, even if I change at work into kind of on-air clothes. It's just our mindset has changed, and I think about what I really need. What about the supply chain? How did that work throughout the pandemic, or how has what happened during the pandemic maybe changed how you want to do it going forward?
I think from our manufacturer's standpoint, they've done an amazingly good job. People have pivoted very quickly with either gearing up or gearing down production. And some of them had a hard time with COVID. Some people had to close their plants because of heavy COVID cases. But generally, they've been able to manage it relatively well. Where we've seen problems is really getting goods into the country. The port congestion has just been really terrible on the West Coast, and that tends to add literally weeks to the supply chain. In addition to that, you've seen increases in pricing coming into the U.S., and then from your hubs getting deliveries to consumers. That's also been increasing in price. And probably the scariest thing that's been happening is a lack of labor market.
Yeah.
People are happy to stay home and collect unemployment versus going out and getting a job in a pretty hot economy.
I was reading some things that some are speculating that Land's End stock is getting caught up in the meme stock trading. What do you say to that? What are your thoughts on this? And I'm curious if you're getting questions about this.
We have a smaller float. So you'll see when it comes to announcement times around the quarters, you'll see some pretty volatile swings in and out of the announcement date. But generally, no, I wouldn't think that we're a meme stock at this point in time.
Okay, so not worried about getting caught up in the craziness of it.
I'm not worried about it, no.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the business because there's a lot of stuff that's interesting going on. First of all, one thing I want to ask you, you mentioned uniforms before. That's a big business. I've bought uniforms for you for my daughter for school. I'm assuming that business, did it stop completely or fall off a lot in the past year?
In 2020, it fell off pretty far.
Yeah.
A couple of parts of the business were tough. Obviously, the school part of the business was very difficult. And then in our national accounts, we have an inordinately large relationship with the travel industry. So we do Avis Rent-A-Cars, Hampton Inns, Delta Airlines, American Airlines, and that was challenged. But what we've seen coming into the back part of 2020 and then into 2021 is a much faster than expected recovery. The area that's still challenged in the uniform business is really the small, medium-sized businesses, and that's going to be dependent upon the economy as we run through 2021 to come back.
But is it getting back to or close to pre-pandemic levels from what you're seeing from some of the bigger accounts?
Yeah, it is. We think that the school business will be back to pretty much normal by this year, and then the national account business, depending on the back part of the year, but we see that going much faster than what we had anticipated.
So talk to me about this third-party marketplace for sellers. Interesting.
Yeah, we brought the technology in last year and formally launched the marketplace in the fourth quarter of 2020. It performed very well for us over the holiday season, and what we've done is gone out to many other brands in areas that produce product that we really don't make. So we're looking at additional home products like furniture and homewares, things like that, additional shoes, and then accessories, jewelry, scents, beauty, and bringing
high margin. That's a higher margin business, right?
Well, it's a good margin business for us. What's great is it's low risk because we take the information, put it all up on our website, but the manufacturers are drop shipping for us, going directly to the consumer. So it gives the consumer, when they come onto our website, a much broader range of products to shop that they're looking for, and it's really de-risking it for us.
Jerome, how big a business could that be for you guys, especially if you don't have the overhead of the distribution like Amazon does? How big of a business could it ultimately be for you?
It could be tens to hundreds of millions, but we're still in the point right now where we're sizing it. We're bringing on many more brands as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
We expect to be well over 60 brands by the time that we get to holiday this year, and continuing to grow that and scale it over the course of the next few years.
Hey, one last thing, partnerships, Draper James, Reese Witherspoon, how important is that to kind of, you know, keeping the brand relevant, if you will?
Yeah. Just quickly. It's great for the buzz. Yeah. And what's even better than that is it's been great for the bottom line. We've been really pleased with the results that we saw last year and then again this spring. In fact, we're expanding our partnership with them in the back part of the year with home furnishings and sleepwear.
Yeah.
And we've got some other exciting news coming down the pike, which we'll be able to talk about in a quarter or two. So we're working on some other fun stuff.
Looking forward to catching up at another date on that exciting news. That was Lands' End CEO Jerome Griffith leading a company, Tim, that's diversifying the types of products and services it's offering, and investors certainly taking notice.
Yeah, stock on a tear, really, over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic. Coming up in our next hour, we go inside the C-suite at BNY Mellon's Pershing with CEO Jim Crowley and COO Emily Schlosser. That's ahead of the annual Insight Conference on Investment Strategy.
Yeah, we find out what's on the mind of investment professionals, what their clients want to know about.
You know, some of the things that clients are looking for are really around digital capabilities, which, not surprising, and has certainly been accelerated by what we've seen through the course of the pandemic. I think the clients are really looking for enhanced usability. I mean, really, their expectations are being set by the ease with which they can do anything else in the digital world, from personal banking to ordering an Uber to getting food and groceries delivered, right? So we're seeing an elevated expectation around the ultimate usability and experience.
Plus, the CEO of a Napa Valley winery and the head of the Beer Institute talk alcohol making in the wake of the pandemic.
Spoiler alert, we're still drinking.
Which one, beer, wine, or both?
A little bit of both.
All right, good to know. You're listening to Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including our conversation with both the CEO and COO of BNY Mellon's Pershing. We're talking about Jim Crowley and Emily Schlosser. Emily, by the way, actually entered the C-suite at the height of the pandemic.
Yeah, taking on that job remotely back in over the summer. Wild. Plus, the CEO of a Napa Valley vineyard talks about how a pandemic and climate change are impacting wine sales.
First up this hour, though, a story online at Bloomberg Business Week that we want to draw your attention to about the shine coming off the golden child of tech. And by that, we mean Apple.
For more, we talked to Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber and Bloomberg News reporter Joe Light, as the Cupertino-based firm is now getting the same type of scrutiny as its fellow tech giants in the midst of a crucial legal battle.
Apple is kind of getting hit on four fronts. You know, the first, as you mentioned, is this epic lawsuit. The second, they were hauled in front of Congress in April to answer questions from lawmakers around its app store and kind of accusations that it's, you know, anti-competitive, that they're not allowing enough competition to put programs onto iPhones. Then they've, in May, they faced, you know, kind of two issues. They face, as you said, Tim Cook, he actually took the stand in that epic trial and faced some of those antitrust accusations. And then the New York Times came out with an investigation about some of Apple's activities in China, which just brought a new wave of scorn from lawmakers who, you know, say that Apple was kind of sacrificing some of the privacy of its users in China in order to gain access to that market. So, as you said, it was kind of nothing at all for a few years, you know, during the Trump administration. Tim Cook had a very good relationship with Donald Trump. And now all of a sudden you have all these things kind of hitting the company at once.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, no, the only thing I was going to say, I always thought that was unusual, like Tim Cook and Donald Trump. Like, I tried to get my head around like the visual.
I'll never forget him standing next to the president and not correcting him when he was making statements about the factory in Texas a few years ago.
Right.
Joe, I'm wondering about potential worst case scenarios here for Apple. Among the many challenges that you spoke about, what's the worst case scenario for Apple here? Is it Epic prevailing in this fight?
So the Epic lawsuit, I mean, Apple could potentially, you know, lose some of its power over the App Store if Epic wins. I mean, the worst case scenario for Apple is if it starts getting hit with antitrust lawsuits from governments, you know, whether it's the federal government. The Bloomberg's reported that as late as January, DOJ investigators were interviewing a developer on the App Store. So clearly they're doing some sort of investigation around that. Some state governments have also brought lawsuits against those other companies, against Amazon, against Facebook, against Google. And if it starts getting hit with those sorts of antitrust lawsuits, I mean, that's where the real pressure comes. I mean, all this lawmaker stuff, you know, they say mean things, but very rarely does it actually result in some sort of legislation. But, you know, these federal enforcers are a completely different story.
I think you're right there. Like, you know, it sounds good to talk mean and, you know, but it's another thing to actually, like, wield a stick, Joe. But, you know, one of the things that I wonder here is, do you feel that, you know, is it worse for Apple that, you know, face something, you know, on a one-on-one basis, or to be sort of part of like a zone defense where you've got, you know, they get wrapped up in things that might also affect the Amazons and Facebooks of the world, you know, other tech companies?
Well, I guess you'd much rather be, you know, kind of one in a crowd of people who are facing ire. I mean, you know, in the same way, like, you know, you want to be like, if you're a zebra, you know, you kind of want to be in the middle of the herd and kind of blend in and hope that you're not the one that the lion takes down or whatever. But the, you know, once they start facing this one-on-one scrutiny, you know, from these enforcers, I mean, one of the lessons we had from Microsoft, which faced its own antitrust scrutiny, you know, like 20 years ago, is Microsoft ultimately won that case. But because of the pressure, because they didn't want to be seen as to, you know, growing into other businesses that could face even more anti-competitive scrutiny, they missed out on some business. You know, people say that that's what gave Google the opening to become the giant that it became. So that's the sort of, you know, thing that Apple's going to want to avoid, you know, fight this scrutiny while also being aggressive in innovating and in business expansion.
But, you know, you also make a good point that, you know, ultimately, even the pressure, the political pressure that Apple and some other tech companies have faced, you know, it's uncomfortable. It gives great fodder for us to talk about on radio and on TV and in Business Week magazine and online, but ultimately it didn't really hurt them too much financially.
Right. Yeah. So ultimately the thing that, you know, I'm sure Apple executives are going to want to avoid is where they decide, you know, not to do something, you know, some, you know, what one of their attorneys or even an executive in his own mind says, no, we're not going to expand into that business line because we know that, you know, such and such investigator, that'll be just another thing for this investigator or for this lawmaker, to yell at us about. So that's the sort of kind of, you know, self-editing of their business that could ultimately be the effect of, you know, all this scrutiny.
Bloomberg News reporter Joe Light and Business Week editor Joel Weber.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, how investment advisors are handling the SPAC IPO trend, meme stocks, and everything in between. There's a lot going on in the financial world. BNY Mellon's Pershing CEO Jim Crowley and the company's COO Emily Schlosser, they join us next.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
A favorite event where we get to check in with what's on the minds of investment professionals, from advisors and asset managers to broker dealers and family offices, they all collect together in an event this week.
It's the annual BNY Mellon Pershing Insight Gathering, held in a virtual format this year. We caught up with BNY Mellon's Pershing CEO, Jim Crowley, and the company's COO, Emily Schlosser, to talk all about the trends investment advisors say their clients want to know about.
And, Tim, how the last year has really changed how advisors advise.
It has been, you know, obviously the last 15 months have been quite a challenge. And, you know, two priorities, really. First was obviously the safeguarding, you know, the health and the well-being of all of our people. That was priority one. And then, you know, the second thing, Carol, that really became clear to us is that there really is no substitute for business continuity planning and testing of your business continuity processing, because it became clear in March when we left the office on March 13th, literally overnight, we were virtual, working from home. And thankfully, we didn't miss a beat through what was really tremendous volume and volatility.
Emily, come on in here and talk a little bit about what it's been like for you as chief operating officer. What are the changes that you've made, and how are you thinking that some of those changes are going to be permanent on the other side of this?
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, and thanks to both of you for having us. It's been quite a ride, as Jim pointed out. So I joined the company as chief operating officer last July in a fully virtual environment, which
wow.
was interesting to say the least.
Yeah.
I did have the privilege of meeting Jim briefly before I started, but otherwise I've worked largely for the last year virtually with all of my new colleagues. But it's been great. Look, we have adopted very quickly to the virtual environment. And we are thinking very carefully about what does this mean for the future. And I think we're seeing employees that are really getting accustomed to working from home and having that flexibility. And then also people who are itching to get back in and interact with people in person. So we're looking at options for how we continue with a hybrid work environment to achieve both of those needs while building the best environment to serve our clients.
I just want to dive right into that because, man, Tim and I, every day there are stories on the Bloomberg, especially within the financial community, that you are seeing a lot of, it feels like we got to be back in the office. And it feels like the tone of the conversation, Jim, has changed a little bit from maybe a year ago. We were like, well, maybe this hybrid stuff makes sense. I remember James Gorman thinking about maybe we give up some real estate space to where everybody now says, wait, we got to be back in the environment. Your financial community, you guys are working with folks that are dealing with, millions and millions of investor accounts globally on a daily basis. What are they saying? Are they hybrid? Are they back in the office? What do they anticipate?
Well, many of our clients, Carol, are back in the office. I can't say, though, that there is any one client that is back in the office full time with their full staff. Mm. I think most people are still sort of working through this environment and trying to figure out how to be hybrid, who really is essential in office and who really isn't necessary to be in office. And in fact, for our clients, the most important thing for them is being in front of investors, being in front of their clients. And that
is there a lot more virtual going on with that, and people, are clients comfortable with that, Jim?
Much more virtual, though. I have to say, though, clients, particularly when you're talking about their investments and their life planning, they really do want to have a personal relationship. And having a personal relationship through a WebEx or any other sort of form of video conferencing isn't the same as sitting across the table or meeting in the restaurant. And, I've actually, myself and Emily, we've been on a couple of business trips now where we've actually met with clients in offices. And it's the energy is so much better and the opportunity to communicate clearly and sort of get a sense of what the other person is feeling and thinking. It's much more valuable.
Jim, something we talk about on a daily basis here at Bloomberg, these meme stocks and the rise of alternative investing platforms, whether it's Reddit, whether it's Robinhood, we are really kind of watching this and how it's upending what seems to be kind of the mainstay financial community. What are your members? What are your, the groups that, the folks that come to Insight, what do they want to know about this?
Yeah, so it's been quite interesting, Carol. Thankfully, our platform has, through all the Reddit and meme stock, volume volatility, has performed quite well. Our clients, interestingly enough, while we see elevated transaction volumes in these names, the overall dollar value, notional value of the transactions and things that we're doing for our clients, it's relatively small because our clients are much more what I would call financial planning based, wealth based. And so while there may be some transaction activity in these names, it on a relative basis is really, it's a fraction of their overall, what they're dealing with when they talk about the wealth of their clients.
Hey, Emily, come on back in on our conversation. You worked at Goldman, you were in charge of their global markets division. You operationally have had to look at BNY Mellon Pershing and, look at what the needs are for clients and your team around the globe. How do things look in terms of us getting on the other side of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I did come from Goldman. I was in charge of change management there at their global markets division. And so
am excited to bring much of my transformation expertise to Pershing. You know, some of the things that clients are looking for are really around digital capabilities, which not surprising and has certainly been accelerated by what we've seen through the course of the pandemic. I think the clients are really looking for enhanced usability. I mean, really, their expectations are being set by the ease with which they can do anything else in the digital world, from personal banking to ordering an Uber to getting food and groceries delivered, right? So we're seeing an elevated expectation around the ultimate usability and experience. And as such, we are uplifting our advisory and investment platforms to improve the way that our advisors can help their clients move money, so they can onboard new accounts. We're providing new modern look and feel, streamlined navigation. So we're really excited about what we can bring to bear in terms of our digital platforms.
That was BNY Mellon's Pershing CEO Jim Crowley and the company's COO Emily Schlosser.
Yeah, some great insight there. Well, still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we finish off the week with a half hour on booze, 30 minutes.
Okay, that's enough.
First from a CEO of a Napa Valley winery.
And then from the president of the Beer Institute.
All in an effort to find out how a pandemic has changed America's drinking habits.
You're listening to Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So this last half hour, we're going to relax, kick back, enjoy a few conversations about wine and beer.
We certainly are. Later, we're going to hear from the president of the Beer Institute. First up, though, a look at the wine industry in California.
Love this. You caught up with David Duncan, the CEO at Silver Oak Winery, and spoke about how the pandemic has impacted the overall wine industry.
Yeah, and specifically how things have been in my home state of California with the droughts, the fires, and just the way the climate has been changing.
Yeah, it's been really a fascinating, exercise, if you will, from a production standpoint. And, you know, being a vintner and making wine, it's all been pretty much, you know, normal. We've been growing grapes and making wine, and our teams, you know, we're keeping all of our employees safe and doing everything that we can to deal with the pandemic. From a consumer standpoint, it's been just an amazing change. You know, we focus on selling our wines in restaurants, and as our restaurant partners across the country and really around the world were forced to close, we were worried, frankly, and we found that the consumers, found other ways to purchase wine. And so working with, fine wine shops and all the way the states opened up to allow wine shipping really allowed us to shift our focus and provide, you know, the wines into people's glasses where they were. And I think as the restaurants come back, we're really going to see the demand shift again. So
can you talk about those? Yeah, talk about the regulatory changes here, because I have this memory of I grew up on the Central Coast of California, wine country, on the Central Coast wine country. And I have this memory of going to UPS with a case of wine and trying to ship it to a friend of mine in Maine. And this was, 15, 17 years ago. And that they told me I couldn't do that. And I didn't understand why at the time. Take me into the regulatory changes over the last year that has allowed you to ship wine.
Well, 10, 12 years ago, we were only allowed to ship wine into 13 states directly. And that really has to do with the repeal of prohibition, back in the 30s, and how it was given to state control. So each state has its own distribution model. Some states are state controlled. Most states are, you have to sell through a distributor. They call it the three-tier system. So it's producer to distributor to either retailer or restaurant. And so there was a perception really that if you cut out the distributor, they wouldn't make money. And so the distribution would be fighting for their share. But I think what really happens is what I call the buying occasion. So, you're probably familiar with different wines that you enjoy. And if you can find them at your fine wine shop, for say, $50 a bottle, but at a restaurant, that same bottle is $75 a bottle. You're willing to pay that because it's like buying a steak at, you know, at the grocery store and grilling it yourself versus having the same steak, you know, on the menu and prepared and brought out on a clean white plate. You know, so I think there's so that's basically and you know, the producers and really helped to promote the idea, and the states responded that the consumers were there, and with restaurants closed, we needed to be able to sell our product. And so many states, I think we can ship to 45 states now. So, you know, it's changed pretty dramatically, and it'll be interesting to see how that model continues to evolve as we come back out of the pandemic.
David, is that a permanent shift?
Yeah, I don't think we know that yet. I think there's definitely a call for that, and I think the consumer enjoys it. I think we've proved that we're not shipping wine to minors, you know, especially ultra premium wines, and which has always been an argument. And so, yeah, I think the landscape has permanently changed. You know, I think some of it will regress, but I think for the most part, we're going to remain in this type of model going forward.
Do you think the industry faces, though, an existential threat from climate change?
Well, I have my answer to that question is generally that if we can't grow Cabernet in Napa Valley, we're going to have a lot bigger problems on our hands than that. You know, so I think that there certainly is. You know, it seems warmer, although I can tell you, I just got the data from our vineyard team that the average temperature in Napa Valley in this spring was 10 degrees below the 33-year average. I mean, that is a remarkable thing. It was a cold spring, and we're seeing the vine growth kind of starting off slow. So I don't like to call it global warming. I call it climate change, you know, and it may be actually too cool here, you know.
Wow.
So. I think it's a difficult problem.
That's David Duncan, the CEO at Silver Oak Winery.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, Tim, we switch from wine to beer. We check in with the CEO of the Beer Institute, Jim McGreevy. You kind of like low specialty beers?
Yeah, I like the low alcohol beers these days.
Oh, that's right.
Every few years, I kind of switch it up.
Go from low to high?
Well, I think, it speaks to the trends that are shaping the beer industry.
Yeah, there's so many different choices when it comes to beer. All right, so we'll get the lowdown from Jim in just a moment.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We're going to wrap up with more on the alcoholic beverage industry, this time with a 25-year veteran of policy and political work who now heads the Beer Institute, which is the national trade association that represents America's brewers, beer importers, and supply chain partners. He sees it all.
He does, and it adds up, according to their website, to a $328 billion industry that supports more than 2.1 million American jobs. For more on the pandemic and post-pandemic worlds of the industry, we checked in with Jim McGreevy, president and chief executive officer of the Beer Institute.
Where we were a year ago is probably where so many other Americans were a year ago, personally and in their jobs, really trying to figure out as of March 13th and around there where our industry would be going. Thankfully, the federal government made the production and distribution of beer essential as part of the grocery system. So we were able to keep our breweries and many of our folks employed in the making and distribution of beer. Obviously, with the bars and restaurants closed for months on end, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw so many of those jobs lost. Nearly 570,000, as a matter of fact, throughout the U.S., jobs supported by the beer industry. But the Beer Serves America report really it tells the story of a very resilient industry and one that's coming back, we hope, as America comes back. So we're very pleased with some of this data from our biennial report.
Well, it's interesting, you know, local beverage center where we pick up like our cases of water and, you know, whatever else, juices and stuff. But I said to them I hadn't seen them in about a year. And I said, how are you guys? And they said it was really hard because like 80-90% of their business was supplying all of the local restaurants in the community. And that was just shut down. Tell us about your members, because we think about, you know, those of us who go to the supermarket, right, or, you know, to pick up something. But it's the restaurants and the hospitality industry that your members play such a big role on. How hard hit were they?
They were very hard hit, not just from the hundreds of thousands of employees that either lost their jobs on a permanent or temporary basis, but we saw nearly $20 billion in decline in retail beer sales. You think back to that mid-March period of 2020, the March Madness was just getting rolling with the conference tournaments leading to the NCAA tournament. You know, St. Patrick's Day, we loaded in a lot of beer in the bars and restaurants throughout the country for St. Patrick's Day. So many of these holidays, then moving into the summer with Memorial Day, 4th of July, the bars and restaurants in this country were just so hard hit. We're getting near the end of this COVID period, thankfully, and I think we're starting to see these bars and restaurants crowded. I can tell you down here at the Jersey Shore, we saw lines out the door and down the block to get into some of the bars and restaurants at the Jersey Shore. A lot of that gathering is done around a beer. So we're very hopeful for the recovery of the bars and restaurants. It's so important to our country, so important to beer. During the COVID period, we saw significant spoilage of food and beverage, and beer is perishable.
Right.
Nearly $900 million dollars worth of beer that was just perishable, and that just really hurts the industry and hurts the bars and restaurants.
Your industry, are they having any troubles attracting workers, especially as the economy opens up and demand ramps up?
We don't see trouble attracting workers in our breweries and in the distribution business. Again, Carol, it goes back to the bars and restaurants, right?
Right.
Nearly 570,000 jobs lost on a temporary or permanent basis, and you hear lots of discussion around the difficulties of getting people back into those places. And I think we really need to support the recovery by getting those folks back to work. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, our sense is from some of the data we're seeing that the food service in what we call the on-premise, the bars, restaurants, taverns, are starting to come back to pre-pandemic levels. I think we're going to get there, but certainly you do hear from a lot of different corners the discussion around the difficulty in getting some workers. And I think we're certainly seeing that in the bars and restaurants right now.
But we're not at pre-pandemic levels for the industry yet.
No, but, you know, I think we're going to have a big summer for all Americans, and I think for the hospitality industry, and I think for the beer industry. So I'm very hopeful. You just see the economic impact of beer through our Beer Serves America report. 1.6% of U.S. GDP comes from our industry. 2 million Americans owe their livelihoods in one way or another to the production, distribution, and sale of beer. We're coming out of a period where folks were cooped up. They want out, and I think they're going to we're already seeing them sort of hitting the bars and restaurants in this country in a big way, and I think that's only going
to
grow.
I have to say, some of our listeners and followers on YouTube, I think hearing that you said we're going to have a strong summer, saying, well, I'll drink to that. So responding as the world reopens. Hey, listen, one thing I'm curious about, President Biden said to be offering up to create a tax floor 15% down from his earlier proposal to lift the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. So essentially unwinding the tax cuts that the GOP adopted back in 2017. That's what he initially was looking to do. Now it looks like he's backing off of that potentially. I'm assuming your members are in favor of lower rather than higher corporate taxes.
Well, we saw the power of tax relief in our own industry. We are one of the most taxed industries and regulated industries in the country, but we did receive a relief from the excise tax that beer pays in 2020. And 2019, excuse me. And we saw the power of that for our industry. So I think it's great to see seemingly Republicans and Democrats coming together, inching closer towards one another on some kind of deal here on infrastructure, which I think will only help support the recovery. You know, excise tax is a tax that we pay that others do not, but the total taxes paid we see in our Beer Serves America report from beer is $55 billion. So we certainly want to see low taxes But we know in our industry the power of tax relief just in recent years. It's been very helpful to us. So,
what specifically, what happens when there's low taxes? What happens to that money? Because we often talk about it with, you know, publicly held companies that you get a tax break. It's not necessarily higher wages or investment in the business. It's often buybacks. So I'm just curious what happens when there's lower taxes in your industry. What specifically do you see happen?
Yeah, Carol, in 1976, there were 51 breweries left in this country. Today, there are over 8,000. And I can tell you, when we received the excise tax relief over the last few years that we've received, I talked to brewers across the country, large brewers, small brewers, all sort of talking about the same thing. Using that tax relief to hire more workers, to improve their physical plants, their breweries, their tap rooms, their facilities, finding more ways to distribute their beer, innovating more and more. So to me, we see this, we are an industry that has experienced this over the last few years, low taxes drives innovation, it drives jobs, and it drives an industry.
Hey, so in terms of innovation, what are some of the kind of interesting, innovative trends that are happening within the beer industry? You know, we were talking on our planning call, and I was thinking about cannabis and beer, and the political environment seems to be opening up in a big way, certainly when it comes to cannabis, more generally speaking. What are the interesting trends, Jim, that are happening right now?
Oh, beer is always innovating, Carol. You know, a few decades ago, light beer was an innovation of its time. Then we saw the rise of the craft movement and bringing back some of the styles that fallen off the radar screen for a while, particularly IPAs. Today, you see ready-to-drink beverages in so many different ways. The hard seltzer phenomenon of the last 4 years, preceded by the hard soda movement of a few summers ago. That's the great thing about beer. We are always innovating. We want to be where the consumer is. And the consumer right now is looking for more flavor, but also very mindful of health and wellness, calories and other things. So these hard seltzers, the ready-to-drink beverages are really becoming a bigger and bigger part of our industry. Many of them are malt-based. They're made in a brewery. They're made by brewers. That's the kind of innovation you see, and you hear so much about these different hard seltzer brands now. But there's always something new in beer. Beer is an incredibly dynamic industry.
Just got about 20, 25 seconds here. When you talk to your members, the outlook, the economic market outlook, how does it look for the next 6 months to 12 months?
Well, as I said, I think we're hoping for a big summer for every American and for beer in particular. We want to grow those 2 million jobs supported by the beer industry. We want to grow that $332 billion economic input that we have. So, I think that there's always things that can be improved upon. Mm-hmm. But I think the opportunities for beer are great. I think the opportunities for our country are great coming out of this pandemic period. So I'm very hopeful.
That was Jim McGreevy, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Beer Institute.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show. It happens Monday through Friday and starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right, because a lot of the conversations from this week, if you want the full conversation, just check them out, because you will find them there. Bloomberg Business Week 2, available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me at Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
This is Bloomberg.